Last week, Ruthie and I were gone. We were at our national conference. Our church belongs to a fellowship called the International Fellowship of Grace Brethren Churches, and we were in Fremont, Ohio. You know what's in Fremont, Ohio? Nothing is in Fremont, Ohio. Some of you have been there, obviously. But we had a great time, a couple of days of our conference, and then we were able to travel back with George and Rose Ustra. You know, the colonel that is a part of our one of our church favorites here. Yeah, I met him when he was out here in Beale Air Force Base. He is now the chaplain to the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Pentagon. And so he has quite the responsibility there. And so Ruthie and I were able to go with his wife and him to tour the Pentagon on Saturday and to see some of the sites around. Very impressive. Great stories about, you know, 9/11 and the plane that crashed into the Pentagon. And from the terrorist perspective, it was the absolute worst place they could have crashed it. Because if they had crashed it somewhere else in the Pentagon on that particular morning, it would have been much, much more devastating. As we were traveling from Ohio through Pennsylvania back to D.C., we stopped at the Flight 93 Memorial. Remember Flight 93, also a 9/11 plane that left New Jersey on its way to San Francisco. And the hijackers took it over, and then some of the passengers took it back over a little bit later and crashed it into a field in Pennsylvania. We were able to take a little side trip and go see the memorial there. Very moving, very, very moving. As I was in the museum there, one of the most moving portions for me was when you looked up and there were two screens. And one of the screens was a transcript of the conversation taking place in the cockpit. Between the pilots. And then right next to it was another screen that was a flight simulator showing the plane taking off, and you could hear the pilots talking to the tower, and the plane is taken off and it gets altitude. And then about 45 minutes into the flight, you hear the pilots say something to the effect of, "Get out of here, get out of here, what are you doing in here?" And it's when the terrorists took over, and you can see the plane begins to do this as it's flying, as there's a struggle in the cockpit. And then as the terrorist killed the pilot and the co-pilot and then took over the plane, you can see the plane begin to level out a little bit, and you hear them telling the passengers, "We have a bomb, stay seated, we're turning around." And then a little bit later, you hear another struggle in the cockpit and the terrorist saying, "You get out of here, get out of here, get out of here." And again, the plane starts to do this. And you can hear one terrorist ask in Aramaic, the other terrorist, "Should we just end it now? Should we end it now?" The other terrorist said, "Yes, we should." And then you see the plane begin to do this, and you hear an American yell, "No, no, no," and the plane goes down. Okay. Very powerful moment. And as I was walking back out to see the actual dirt, because you can walk outside and see where the plane actually hit, and it's a scraped hillside where they did some coal mining, and they scraped the hillside, extracted all the coal, and then put the dirt back and planted a little prairie there. And the plane, when it went down, because the dirt was soft, it just went right into the ground and imploded. And it had so much fuel, because it was going from New Jersey to California, that everything just disintegrated. And, you know, we've heard the stories of the passengers taking over the plane. There was a phone you could pick up in the museum and listen to some of the calls that passengers made back home. You know, "Honey, I love you. I don't know what's going to happen. Honey, my flight has been hijacked." And one person saying, "Hey, my safe is in my closet in my bedroom. Here's the combination, all my papers." And just a frightful time. And as I was thinking about that and thinking about our story today, it just made me ask the question, when those passengers were sitting in that plane and they'd heard about all the other planes crashing, what was it in them that made them get up out of their chair and rush the cockpit? What did they believe so deeply that they would conspire together to get up out of their chair and go? As Todd Beamer famously said, "Let's roll." Because none of them knew how to fly the plane. So they knew that if they throw the terrorists out of the cockpit, most likely it was going to be the end. What was in them that got them out of their chair? Today in our story, We're not going to find three guys that get up out of their chair. We're going to find three guys that refuse to bend their knee. And whatever was going on in the passenger's heart, I think was something similar going on in these three friends' heart in the book of Daniel. The king had erected the statue and had said, when you hear the band start up, bend your knee and worship it. And when the band started up, these three friends just said, can't do it. Can't do it. We're talking about convictions. Living a life of conviction. You know, over the course of the book of Daniel, we've been looking at the different chapters. I've been giving a name or a word to each chapter. Chapter 1, living a life of courage. The whole series in Daniel is called Living a Life of Greatness. If I want to live a great life, I've got to be a person of courage. If I want to live a great life, we saw in chapter 2, I need to be a person of influence. And we learned some principles in chapter 2 about how to be a person of influence. And in chapter 3, living a life of conviction. And this morning, we're seeing that there's conviction in the midst of pushback. You know, if you're going to be good parents, you need convictions, don't you? If you're going to have a good marriage, that marriage needs to be founded upon some convictions. If you're going to get through the tough stuff that you've been going through and come out all right on the other side, if you're going to go through what David called the valley of the shadow of death and come out okay on the other end, there better be some deep-seated convictions that you hang on to as you go through the difficulties. We're going to see convictions today in the midst of pushback. Now, a couple weeks ago, we talked about the difference between preferences, conscience, and convictions. And we saw that preferences are personal or individual choices, which are neither right or wrong. We all have preferences. We have preferences about what we like to eat. We have preferences about what we believe. We have preferences about what we do or what we don't do. And your preferences are different than my preferences. And my children's preferences are different from the other children's preferences. It's okay to have a vast variety of preferences. Somehow we all have to be able to work together in our family in the midst of preferential differences. So in your family growing up, one person preferred this, and as you met with friends, as you're growing up, some families had different preferences than others. And even when it comes to spiritual things, we're doing our summer home group, and our group has a variety of people in it, and some have the preference to do the Bible study this way, and some would like to do the Bible study this way, and some people like me just want to get together and eat and talk to each other, you know? And so we have different preferences. When we come together like this for worship, we come with a variety of preferences, and we as a leadership team are really strongly trying to build an interdenominational or multi-generational worship experience. If you look around the room, there are people from different generations. And how do we get all those preferences to come together in one experience? Well, the Bible says that we give preferential treatment to one another. When I have people over for dinner, I might set aside my preferences to do their preference. When we have Bible study, I might set aside their preference to do my preference. Or, you know, when we come together, sometimes we have to set aside, because they're just preferences. They're neither right or wrong. We all have them. We also talked about conscience choices. Now, conscience choices are stronger. These are right and wrong for me personally. They may not be right or wrong for you, but for me, my conscience says I need to believe this. Or my conscience says I need to do this or I need to not do this. We see it in our country all the time when it comes to the issue of war. Some people are conscientious objectors. Their conscience won't let them go to war. We see it when it comes to the variety of ethical choices or business practices. Some people just have consciences that won't let them or demand that they do one thing or another. And we have these personal choices that are for us, our conscience choices. And we need to follow our conscience. Because that is how God is directing you. He may not be directing me that way, but he's directing you that way, so it's very important. It's very important. We see it in Daniel when Daniel says, I don't want to eat that stuff because it violates my conscience. We see in the New Testament where they were eating meat sacrificed to idol, and some people in the church were up in arms because you shouldn't do that stuff. And Paul says, well, it's up to your conscience. There's conscience choices. And again, I want to give room because that's your conscience. I'm not going to force my conscience on you, and you're not going to force it on me. We give each other space. But then the third one that we're mainly talking about in this chapter is moral convictions. Moral convictions are something that is right or wrong for everyone. That without a shadow of a doubt, everyone must do this, or everyone must not do this. I think there's only 11 of them. It's the Ten Commandments, and then it's the Great Commandment, which is to love God and love your neighbor as what? As yourself. Thou shalt not steal. We think it's wrong for all of us to steal. That's why we don't cheat on our taxes, because we don't want to steal from the government, as hard as that is to say, isn't it? Okay? Stealing is wrong. Murder is wrong in all of its ramifications. So my convictions don't come from within me, because if my convictions that I think are right and wrong for everyone, if the source of the authority of those convictions is me, well, I'm no more authoritative than you. So my convictions, our convictions don't come from within us. We believe God exists and that God made our world and that God made us, and he knows how we best function together. So he gave us moral convictions that we all abide by. That's how we function best together. So our convictions don't come from within us, they come from God. And we follow his convictions. I think that's why I think it's the Ten Commandments. Don't defraud your neighbors, one of them. So I'm not going to defraud. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to steal. I'm not going to cheat. I'm going to be faithful to one God. Those are the commandments. I'm going to love him with everything I got. Now, the problem in our culture today, the issue that we face, is that moral convictions are being erased. That in our culture today, the only moral conviction that's out there is that whatever you want to be is what you should be. And that I need to promote you to be whatever you want to be. Moral convictions are being erased. Moral convictions about sexuality. Moral convictions about sexual practices, moral convictions about what I drink, what I smoke, what I think, where I go. Our culture today is erasing moral convictions. So if you stand for anything, you better be ready for some pushback. Because if you have a moral conviction other than the one that says you can be whatever you want to be, then you're going to receive some pushback. I gave you a challenge a couple weeks ago. Just go to your social media site, go into your portal, and just type in, Jesus is the only person that should ever be worshipped. And see the response that you get. Now, do we believe that? Do we believe that Jesus should be the only one that should be worshipped? Yes, we believe that. Amen, we believe that. But our culture says, whoa, 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 you can't have that as a moral conviction. But again, if I want to have a solid marriage, it's got to be founded on moral convictions. If I want to be a good parent, if I want to be a good business owner, if I want to be a good student, part of the problem with students heading off to college, if you're not secure in your convictions, the world is going to dump theirs on you. How do I get through the tough, deep, depressing, hurtful, painful situations in life without giving up on God? I better have some moral convictions. King David did. That's Psalm 23, right? Though I go through the valley of the shadow of death, I will what? Fear no evil, for thy rod and thy staff are with me. He had convictions. Job, after he lost everything, said this, even though God slay me, I will not deny him. I will not. Now, that's just not blind faith. That's moral conviction. And when those passengers were sitting on Flight 93, I'm telling you, there's some moral convictions deep in their hearts that got them to get up out of their chair and rush the cockpit. Don't know what it was. Was it patriotism? Was it just was it just hating evil? What was it? Today, our three friends are not going to bow. And we're going to be able to peek inside their heart to see what is the moral conviction that forced them to stand when everyone else was kneeling. We're going to see, you know, the story is the king's effigy in the desert. The king builds this statue. We're not exactly sure what it looked like. It was a statue of gold. And because in chapter 2 and the dream about the other statue and King Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold, we think that probably this statue was a representation of Nebuchadnezzar's divine position. He viewed himself as the king of the world. In fact, Daniel told him, you're the king of the world because that's the position God has given to you right now. And so he builds this image, we think, that reflects himself. It's to be seen. It's put out on the plain of the desert. And when the band strikes up, you are to bow down and you are to worship the image. And the king said, if you don't do it, you're going to be thrown into the fiery furnace. Now, we know the king, right? His two favorite things now to do to people that don't follow him. One is what? Rip them what? Limb from limb and burn your house to the ground. That's his favorite one. Well, now we see his second favorite revenge against you is to throw you into a furnace of blazing fire. So you can kind of get the attitude of this king. Now, let's jump into our section today. We're going to start there in verse 8. And the first thing that we notice is there's some vindictive co-workers push back against these three friends. It says in verse 8, for this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. And they responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, O king, live forever. Now, if you like to underline phrase in your Bible, underline that phrase, O king, live forever. Basically, they're just slurping on the king. They know he's not going to live forever, but you only say that to deities, and King Nebuchadnezzar viewed himself as a deity, and so, O king, live forever. They're trying to exert their loyalty to him, and as they tell what's going on. So they know how to push the right buttons. In verse 10, it says, you, O king, notice that, you, O king, O mighty one, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, is to fall down and worship the golden image. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And then he says, there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In fact, if you go back to chapter 2 and verse 49, you'll see that that's the king does appoint those three friends over the province of Babylon. These men, O king, now watch this, here's three accusations. These men, O king, number one, have disregarded you. They're dissing you. They're disrespecting you. They're ignoring you. That's the hot button for Nebuchadnezzar. Nobody ignores Nebuchadnezzar. Nobody disrespects the king of the earth. Number two, they do not serve your gods. Remember, we talked several times that the strength of your God was the center point of the ancient world. My God is stronger than your God. My God protects my kingdom. If my kingdom falls to your kingdom, it must be because your God is stronger than my God. And they are not serving your gods. And you'll notice the personal pronoun, your gods. Or worship the golden image which you have set up. There's the three accusations, and they're all made very personal. Hey, king, these three guys are insulting you. They're insulting the core of what you believe. And they're insulting your expression of your divine position. Because the statue in the wilderness was an expression of Nebuchadnezzar's divine position in the world. And when they won't worship it, they're disrespecting your authority. They're disrespecting your reputation. Those are the three accusations. And I want you to notice there that they're posturing to his ego. They are playing to Nebuchadnezzar's ego. Hey, they're disrespecting you, buddy. They're disrespecting your core beliefs. And they're disrespecting your position in our world. And at the beginning, they say, O king, live forever. Oh, King, you're the best. So they're posturing to his ego. I put down there in your notes, Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 5, and it reads this: a man who flatters his neighbor is spreading a net for his steps. Let me tell you something. If someone comes around and all they do is slurp on you, pat you on the back, tell you how great you are, be careful, because they're setting a net for you. They're setting a trap for you. They want to use that friendship to accomplish their own agenda. So when someone comes around and all they do is sing your high praises, your antenna should go up because they're flattering you because you're not really as good as they say you are, and they're trying to set you up for something. These Chaldeans were vindictive against the people that took their positions, and now they're using flattery to the king to accomplish their agenda. And he buys into it. So the result of that, verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar in rage and anger. Now, if you like to underline phrases, this guy is in rage and anger. It's bad enough to be enraged, but to be enraged and wrathful, one version says. Have you ever gotten to that state yourself? You remember when you're an adolescent and your hormones just got away from you? And you were just not just angry. You were like anger on top of anger. You just lost control. Have you ever gotten so mad you just lose control? Okay, I guess I'm just talking to myself this morning, okay? None of you obviously have. Some people get so mad they lose control once in a while, okay? All right, I've heard of it. I've never seen it, but I've heard of that some people do. Nebuchadnezzar, because they're stroking his ego, he goes into a fit of rage. He is angry on top of his wrath. And you think that what he's going to do is he's going to start tearing people limb from limb. And he's going to start tearing their houses to the ground or throwing them into the fiery furnace. And it says he gave orders to bring them in verse 13, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded to them and said, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image which I have set up?" And no, it's interesting is he doesn't bring up the first accusation. If you'll notice here, he only refers to the second and the third accusation. The first accusation was they have disregarded you. And it's interesting that King Nebuchadnezzar doesn't accuse them of that, because probably because he's been working with them for years and he has seen their respect for him. That he knows these people don't disregard me. So he doesn't even bring up the first accusation. He only brings up the second and the third. Hey, you're not going to serve my gods or worship the golden images I've set up. Now, if you are ready at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery and bagpipe and all kinds of music, fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well. But if you do not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And then here is his most proudful, if that's a word, his most prideful boast ever. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? Nebuchadnezzar has reached the point in his ego that not only is he king of his empire, not only king of the world, not only can he set up an image for people to worship that image that reflects his divine position, he says, "I am more powerful than the gods. I am more powerful than the gods." It's interesting to me in this story that God doesn't show up until after this statement. It's interesting how God doesn't show up until he's challenged. It's a crazy thing to challenge God. Either by saying he doesn't exist, or by saying he doesn't matter, or by misrepresenting his character, or by saying, "I am in control of my life, and God, you are not." Be very careful at that moment. If I were to say something like that, a dear friend of mine would just simply take one step away from me, because he knows the lightning's coming. Who can deliver me out of your hands? Well, that sets into motion a mighty rescue. A mighty rescue. The first thing that we see here is a confident response. In verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter." In other words, hey, we're not going to spend a lot of time explaining our position. We're not going to spend a lot of time explaining about the image and our beliefs and your gods and my gods. Let's just cut to the chase. Let's not make this a long, drawn-out conversation, king. We're not going to give you a long answer. We're going to give you a Twitter response, and here it is. "If it be so, God," verse 17, "if it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us out of the fire, or the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." A conviction that ran so deep. The same kind of conviction that got passengers out of their chair is the same idea that these folks had convictions that wouldn't let their knees bend. And their statement is very simple. Our God, who we serve, is so mighty and so powerful, he's going to overthrow anything you want to do to us. And we will not bow our knee to anyone but him. If it be so, he can deliver us. There's confidence in God's ability. He can deliver us from the fiery furnace. He's going to deliver us from your hand. The trial that you're throwing our way, Nebuchadnezzar, our God can overcome that trial. Our God can overcome you. But even if our God decides not to rescue us, we're still going to serve him. That's conviction. Unconditional conviction and allegiance to God. Boy, do we have that kind? Our culture is erasing convictions. Our culture is telling us, you don't need to do that. You don't need to be that passionate about following Jesus. Do we have the conviction, okay, God, you can get me out of this, but maybe you won't. And I am still going to serve you. That's a conviction that I want to have in my life. A confident response. And then we see a miraculous deliverance or protection. I love verse 19. Look at verse 19. "Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath." Well, he was already filled in verse 13 with rage and anger. And wrath means now I'm going to get you. I was filled with anger, but now I'm going to turn that anger and punish you in a vengeful way. I'm going to be filled with wrath. I love verse 19. "And his facial expression was altered." He screwed up his face. It's like not only was his neck all red and his face all red, now he's just so mad his nose changes and his lips curl. What does it remind you of? It reminds you of mom's look, right? Okay? I mean, you know you're in trouble when you get that look from mom. Okay? You can do a lot of stuff and mom glances your way. Okay, glances your way. But when she does this and looks at you, you are dead meat. You are dead meat. I love it. It's so real, isn't it? His facial expression changed. His ego was out of control. How could these guys have a conviction? And he pushes back. He pushes back. Verse 20, "He commanded certain valiant warriors." Notice, he doesn't pick any soldiers, but the valiant ones. He's going to show these guys. who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and order them to cast them into the furnace of blazing fire. So they're not just tied up by a couple of guys standing around. These are the valiant warriors. They know how to tie guys up. He commanded, verse 21, then these men were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their caps, and their other clothes, and they were cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. I wonder why their clothes were given to us in such detail. Why does it tell us they have trousers and coats and hats and other clothes? I think there's two reasons. Number one, it shows that they dressed appropriately to come in front of the king. When it talks about trousers and coats and caps, it shows that they respected the king enough that when they were summoned, they respected him to the end, even though they knew what kind of guy he was. Well, I don't know about you, but that speaks volumes to us. One of the things that was brought forward in our national conference last week was a declaration. We have a group within our fellowship of churches called the Social Concerns Committee, and every year they just put out ideas about how we as Christians can function in our culture. And you know what they brought up in front of the whole denomination this week or last week? A sense of civility. A declaration of civility. That in our culture today, we've lost our civility. We scream and we yell and we demean each other. And the declaration for our group of churches was that we, as followers of Jesus Christ, although we don't always agree, we commit to be civil and respectful. I see that here. In the way that they dressed before they came before the king. We need to be civil and respectful in our culture today, even if we don't agree. So they came before the king in their trousers. The second reason I think that the clothes are described in detail is in verse 27. It says, when they got out, the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, and the kings and high officials gathered around and saw them in regard to these men, and that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor of the hair of their head singed, nor was their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. Daniel wants us to know that not only were these guys protected in general, God protected them down to every detail of what they were wearing. We're going to wrap it up with this. We don't have time to finish everything today, but let's go to verse 22. For this reason, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace had been set extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew the men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. I want you to see something very important here. God did not rescue them from the fire. Just because you stand up for your convictions doesn't mean God always rescues you. But what God does is he rescues them through the fire. We want the story to end where God intervenes and the three friends never go into the fire. And sometimes God does that. But also many times God lets them fall into the fiery furnace and protects them through the experience. And sometimes in our life, folks, if we're going to stand up and have convictions and receive pushback, it doesn't mean God isn't going to take us through the valley of the shadow of death. It means he's going to walk through it with us. So just because you're experiencing difficulties in your marriage, difficulties with your children, doesn't mean God has forsaken or abandoned or that you're not standing up for what is right. It just means God is going to see you through the experience, not rescue you out of the experience. Does that make sense? And we're going to jump into this as we finish up this chapter next week. And we're going to get into who is this fourth character in the fiery furnace and all that stuff. But let's just end on that note. God is going to see you through the experience, not always rescue you out of the experience. But we need to have strong convictions. What was it that got these passengers to get up out of their chair and rush the cockpit? I wonder if I would have done the same. I wonder what it was so deeply rooted in these three friends that they would not allow their knees to bend. And do we, as followers of Jesus today, in this culture and in this time and in this place, have the same deep-seated convictions that no matter what happens in my life, I will never lose my convictions about who God is and what He wants me to do? I hope we have those kinds of convictions. Let's stand together and pray. Lord, some of us today aren't sure about our convictions. I just pray that you would help us to think through and to be able to write down what our convictions are. I pray that you would give us that deep-seated belief and trust in you that no matter what happens, we're not abandoning our walk with you. No matter how the culture pushes back, I'm not going to give up on my faith in you. Though we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, where we are resolute that yes, you've allowed us to go into that valley, but you're going to see us through. Some of us, Lord, are in that fiery furnace. Our marriage is struggling. Our health is bad. Our finances are terrible. We're discouraged. We're depressed. We're worn out. And we're just considering giving up. Lord, may that conviction rise up within us. May you show us how you're walking us through the fiery furnace. Thank you for these thoughts today and for these truths. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's sing together.